Well, good evening, everybody. Is this working all right? Can you hear at the back? It's a very great pleasure to have Alan Kruger with us to give this Queen's Prize lecture. In case you don't know, the Queen's Prize lectures are to celebrate the award of a Queen's Prize in higher education to the Centre for Economic Performance and the LSE on our account. And they're mainly awarded for the work which we did in labour economics. So, how wonderful that we have here one of the world's greatest labour economists to deliver one of these lectures. Alan is a professor at Princeton. He's head of the famous industrial relations section there. He was a very successful chief economist at the Department of Labour in Washington. And he's probably best known to people who read labour economics textbooks for his work on efficiency wages with Larry Summers and his work on minimum wages with David Card, where he alerted us to the fact that minimum wages don't always reduce employment. But I think of him as the world's leading expert on the economics of education. This is an area which flourished in the 1960s, and almost nothing happened until about 10 years ago when people at Princeton in particular started really seriously addressing the issues again, and Alan has been the leader of this effort. So it's wonderful to have him here giving this lecture. He also has a wonderful son, Ben, who's going to help him with it. So Alan is going to talk to us about education and the economy.
Well, thanks very much, Richard. That was a lovely introduction. I wish half of it were true. I want to begin by congratulating CEP and LSE for having been awarded the Queen's Prize, and I think as Richard mentioned, the topic that I will talk about tonight is quite a fitting one, given all the research that's been done at LSE. What I thought I would do is give a fairly broad-ranging, you could call it discursive, lecture on various topics from the economics of education. And the way I think of this is various lessons that I think emerge from research in the economics of education. I gave this lecture the title, Education Matters. I like the idea of recycling titles I've used before. And I have a collection of past articles called Education Matters. So I thought I would recycle that, Lessons from the Economics of Education. And I'll begin by emphasizing that the human capital model has been a good success story. I think one of the leading success stories in economics. One thing that emerges from research on the economics of education, I believe, and education research more generally, not just by economists, is that the amount of time spent on task, the amount of time studying, amount of time in school, amount of time and effort devoted to learning is a very important determinant, not so surprising, of learning. And there aren't too many shortcuts. I appreciate the fact that my assistant, my son, has put down his comic book. So I think that's a signal that it is going to become serious at this point. And then what I want to do next is turn to some of the trends in both the U.S. and the U.K. To some extent, I think there are similar trends on both sides of the Atlantic, and I also think that the policy reactions have been similar in many respects, and I think some of the lessons are also relevant. And then I'll talk about the ways to enhance human capital. So I have major themes that I thought I would just mention up front. One is, not necessarily sure the answer. That's okay. I know. You can go back. Oh. Nope. There you go. Okay. So we solved that technical difficulty. Human capital is valuable. It's even more valuable now than it was in the past in most developed countries. As I mentioned, time on task matters. One theme that I found in a lot of my research and others have found too, I believe, is that returns to human capital are at least as great for those at the bottom of the distribution, and I left bottom of the distribution unspecified here, but I mean bottom of the income distribution or skills distribution. They seem at least as great at the bottom as they do at the middle and the top, and that's something that comes as a surprise to many people who believe that it's only the elite who seem to get a payoff from education, in fact. I don't think that's accurate. I think it's spread throughout the distribution. And in fact, I think, if anything, the evidence points to higher returns at the bottom. And I'll try to indicate some of the research that points in that direction. Now, unfortunately, there are no magic bullets. There's no, that I'm aware of, no real shortcut for improving the efficiency or the output of the education sector. Some people argue there's a lot of waste. If we could just get rid of the waste, we would improve the efficiency. Well, I'm sure there's some waste, but I don't think it's nearly as great as some have argued. Others argue that, well, we just haven't harnessed the technology yet, or if we have more competition and vouchers, then we'll see a much greater payoff from investment in human capital. And I have to say I'm a bit skeptical of those arguments, and I'll show you some evidence along those lines. And then a final theme I want to emphasize, and this is one that emerges, I think, more and more, is that having independent evaluations, randomized evaluations, is really important in this area. The same kinds of evaluation techniques that have revolutionized medicine, I think, can revolutionize the education field. And I don't think it'll revolutionize the education field overnight, but I think if one wants to look for steady progress, that's the place to look. So if you just hit the space bar, we'll go to the next one. So here's a nice quote from The Wealth of Nations. I figure this is a good place to start. Human capital theory in a nutshell. So Adam Smith wrote, I'm sure many of you remember, a man educated at the expense of much labor and time to any of those employments which require extraordinary dexterity and skill may be compared to one of those expensive machines. The work which he learns to perform, it must be expected, over and above the usual wages of common labor, will replace to him the whole expense of his education with at least the ordinary profits of an equally valuable capital. So the basic idea, of course, is that by investing in skills, workers can improve the job prospects and receive higher wages, and the return would be at least as great as the ordinary return for making that same investment in machinery. And I think that theory holds up remarkably well. First, and this has been known for some time, the next slide, there's a very strong correlation between earnings and years of schooling. This chart just shows you average earnings at each level of education. In the U.S., we now measure education by degrees. We used to use years of schooling for many years. 50 years, the Census Bureau asked what's the highest level of schooling someone attended. Then we switched to collecting information based on degrees, by and large. But you can see, if you put this in terms of years of schooling or degrees, the relationship looks pretty close to log linear. And this has been known for decades. The question, what does it mean? You know, perhaps this is not a causal result of schooling. If you fit a line through these points, you come up with a rate of return to education of about 10% higher earnings for each additional year of schooling. The fit is, especially when you aggregate to this level, the fit is very good. Of course, there's a lot of variability across individuals. But what does it mean? Maybe those who stay in school for 20 years, 18 years, just have more inherent ability. Maybe they have more motivation. The same motivation that drove them to get a high level of education might be what propels them in the labor market. So perhaps we haven't properly measured these omitted variables. Perhaps they have greater connections in the world. Those connections help them to get into a university or help them to get a better job. So if the next slide says, are earnings and education causally linked? Well, here I think that the literature is remarkably strong in the affirmative. Yes, the relationship between earnings and education looks like it's causal. The first studies tried to control as best they could for individuals' characteristics, like their IQ or family background characteristics. And those studies tended to find that maybe some of that upward sloping relationship in the previous slide is due to these omitted factors, but most of it's not. Most of it looks like a true return to schooling. Then another set of studies tried to look for natural experiments, look for reasons why some students might get more education than others. Some use geographic proximity. If you happen to live near a community college, or if a community college in the U.S. is built near your home, it's easier to go on to college. And again, it looks like there's a payoff to schooling that comes about as a result just because of geographic proximity. One line of research, largely initiated by Paul Taubman, died a few years ago now, but used to be at the University of Pennsylvania, Taubman looked at identical twins. And he tried to look at the differences between their schooling and relate that to the differences in their in their earnings. And he found what he believed was substantial downward bias, that much of the measured return to schooling was not, in fact, a result of schooling, but in fact, a result of family background or genetic characteristics. And I have become skeptical of that conclusion, in part because of research I did with my colleague Orly Ashenfelter. This next slide shows you one of our findings. What we did was to go out and collect data on twins ourselves. It was a great deal of fun. Any of you who know Orly know it's usually fun to work with him. We went to the world's largest twins festival, Twinsburg, Ohio. We went there with a group of graduate students. Steve Pischke missed that generation. But we went into the field, quite literally, and we interviewed the twins, and we asked them about their schooling level. We also asked them about their sibling schooling level, because one of the problems is that identical twins tend to have very similar schooling levels. And people tend to make mistakes when they report their education, not often, but sometimes they exaggerate or they forget some years which they don't think are relevant. And there's no reason to think that differences in schooling that are just a result of reporting errors are going to have much impact on earnings. So what we did was to try to get a better measure of education by asking each twin separately how much schooling they have and how much schooling their sibling has. Then we could go back to the library, enter the data in the computer, and we could see how highly correlated their answers are. And they're reasonably highly correlated. What I say my education is and what my identical twin says it is, the correlation's about 0.9. On the other hand, the correlation between our true level of schooling is also high, around 0.6. So when you look at differences in the level of schooling, the measurement error, just the mistakes, are actually quite a high proportion of the variability that we see. So we made an adjustment for the measurement error. You could do it very simply, just taking the average of what I say and what my twin said. Anyhow, when we do that, we ended up with an estimate of the return to a year of schooling, which was a little bit higher than what the ordinary least squares or the most simple approach would show. We ended up with about 11% higher earnings for each additional year of schooling. And you can see here from the scatter diagram, this shows you the difference in the log hourly wage of the twins and the difference in their years of education. And clearly, there's a lot of variability. People's earnings fluctuate from year to year. Some twins happen to be lucky and landed a good job, better job than others. Nevertheless, there is an upward sloping relationship, and it's actually highly statistically significant. Makes me think that the work on twins also points in the same direction, that this relationship between earnings and education is a causal one. And then the final part of the puzzle that I wanted to discuss comes from compulsory schooling studies. The next slide. Joshua Angrist and I have a paper in the Quarterly Journal of Economics that looked at the impact of compulsory schooling. Now, it does this in kind of an indirect way. We saw the following kind of natural experiment or setup to look at the impact of compulsory schooling. So you have to stick with the steps that we have. The first step is that the date that someone is born determines how old they are when they start school. So in the United States, it used to be common to have a January 1st cutoff. You needed to turn 6 by January 1st to start first grade. If you didn't turn 6 by January 1st, then you needed to wait a year. Now, that deadline has actually moved around a bit. In the period we're looking at, January 1st was the most common cutoff. So if you happen to be born on January 2nd, then you'd have to wait a whole year before you started school. You would be one of the oldest students in your class. Now, when you reach the compulsory schooling level, compulsory schooling in the U.S. goes to usually the 16th birthday. Some states have 17th birthday, some states have 18th birthday. So in essence, compulsory schooling requires students to stay in school for a different length depending upon the day of the year they were born, because that determines what grade they were when they, that determines their age when they started school. Children who are born at the end of the calendar year are required to obtain more schooling. Now, not too many students drop out at the compulsory schooling level in the United States, certainly not anymore. And even the period when we were looking at it, was only about 10% of the students left once they reached the compulsory schooling level. The UK, I think, is quite different in that regard, where in the UK you see a much higher proportion of students leaving school once they've satisfied the compulsory schooling level. This setup gives a natural experiment, because unless you think someone's date of birth is related to their inherent ability or their motivation, and I like to say, unless you really believe in astrology, that's pretty unlikely, then date of birth is pretty much random. So we could look at how schooling differences vary with individuals' dates of birth, and then we could relate that to their earnings. So this next slide shows a rather remarkable picture. This is using data from the U.S. Census, so it's a very, very large sample. And what we do is, what we've done is to calculate average years of education by quarter of birth. That was the information we had in the census. And we saw this regular jagged pattern where the individuals who were born in the beginning of the school, beginning of the year, the beginning of the calendar year, quarter one, tended to get a little less education. Those are the ones who were the oldest when they started school and they could drop out at a lower grade level. And the students who were born the end of the calendar year tended to get a little bit more, the fourth quarter births. And we looked at 30 birth cohorts. The next slide shows you we removed the trend, a moving average trend, and it's really remarkable that we found this regular pattern, these little blips down for the beginning of students born in the beginning of the year and blips up for students born at the end of the year. And it showed up in 29 of the 30 birth years that we looked at. Now, these are small differences in education because remember, only about 10% of the students were dropping out as soon as they reached the compulsory schooling level. So it amounts to about a tenth of a year difference in schooling if you look at the magnitude of these blips between the first quarter and the fourth quarter on average. So these are tiny. You couldn't pick them up unless you had an enormous data set. And we did. We had a data set with over 1 million observations from the census. So this was an enormous data set. And then the next thing we did was to look at earnings. The next slide shows you the average of the logarithm of earnings. And those patterns that we saw in years of schooling are mirrored in the earnings of the same individuals. We see these little blips down the first quarter. Thanks for illustrating them. And you do see, if you look at this graph, this is looking at men who were born in the 1930s and 1940s. Earnings rise with work experience, so that's why you see this upward sloping pattern. But if you abstract from that, upward sloping looking from right to left, if you abstract from that, you see that the first quarter births are earning a little bit less on average, and the fourth quarter births are earning a little bit more, and that's good. If you took the ratio of the earnings blips to the education blips, that's the instrumental variables estimator in this case. No, you can go to the next one. You get a rate of return of around 10%. That's what we found when we looked at this at these cohorts. And this finding has been rather controversial. John Bound wrote a paper arguing with co-authors arguing that, if you have weak instruments, and these instruments are fairly weak, the estimates will tend to replicate the simpler estimates, the ordinary least squares estimates. I don't think that's what's going on with the data I just showed you. For one thing, the pattern is too strong. You wouldn't have concluded that these were weak instruments. Others have argued, and Bound has argued as well, maybe someone's date of birth does say something about them. Maybe it's not only a result of their schooling. So one thing we did was to look at people who had more than the minimum level of schooling. They had more than satisfied the compulsory schooling level. And when we did that, we didn't find any relationship between date of birth and earnings or date of birth and education. So the chance of getting a PhD, for example, is pretty much unrelated to your date of birth. So it looks to us like this is picking up the effect of compulsory schooling. But other studies point in the same direction. Work for the UK by Harmon and Walker looked at the impact of raising the compulsory schooling age from 15 to 16. They found an even larger rate of return than what we found. There's a new paper by Kostas McGeer and Morten Palm looking at compulsory schooling in Sweden. The compulsory schooling level there varied across counties, and they found a similar result. And in fact, if you think about this literature, it's really rather remarkable, because what we're saying is, take a group of students, they don't want to be in school, they would drop out if it weren't for the compulsory schooling level, constrain them to stay in school an extra year, and it looks like that extra year of schooling raises their earnings by about 10%. So this has been interpreted as schooling having a rather large impact on the bottom of the education distribution. The students who would otherwise drop out of school at an early age seem like they benefit quite substantially from staying in school longer. Moreover, if you look directly at the income of the students, it looks like it's lower income students who are affected by the compulsory schooling law, which is not so surprising. So one interpretation of these results is a higher return to the schooling, higher payoff to the investment in schooling for those from the bottom of the income distribution. Now, one interpretation of why this might be the case is that individuals from lower income families or who would otherwise get a low level of education, they have high discount rates. They tend to just think about the present. They don't think very much about the future. So when they think about the payoff to schooling, even though it may be very high for them because they have high discount rates, they're not willing to put off entering the job market and making a living. So that's why they have a higher return. They drop out in spite of having a higher return because of their high discount rates. It also, I suspect, is the case that individuals who drop out of school at a low level of education tend to find schooling rather unpleasant. So if you think about the disamenity aspect of schooling, that may be another reason why they get a higher discount rate, why they get a higher rate of return to their schooling. Now, this finding, I think, is rather surprising in one level. At another level, it's not so surprising. I wanted to come back to Adam Smith in this next slide. Thank you. Adam Smith more or less anticipated these results. This is a line from The Wealth of Nations. The difference between the most dissimilar characters, between a philosopher and a common street porter, for example, seems to arise not so much from nature as from habit, custom, and education. So, you know, Smith wasn't emphasizing natural abilities or inherent talent. What he was emphasizing was habit, custom, and education. This is a quote which is pretty much gone by unnoticed. I cited it in a piece I wrote, tell you a kind of interesting aside. And the editor asked me to give the page number. So I asked my research assistant if she could please find the page number. And rather than go to the modern edition, she went to the Rare Book Library at Princeton and requested the first edition. The librarian made a mistake and accidentally gave her the fourth edition, published in 1789. She opened up the book, and she discovered George Washington had signed his name on the front page. Since we're getting close to July 4th, I could tell you the story. And it was actually a rather thrilling discovery. I talked to Emma Rothschild about this, and she told me it wasn't known that Washington had read The Wealth of Nations before. In fact, she made me take a photocopy to a handwriting expert to make sure it was Washington's signature, which it was. So you can see the influence that Adam Smith has had in America. So I think there's not too much controversy about what the micro literature shows, what the cross-individual literature shows on the returns to schooling. There are some puzzles about how we interpret it. And I think a bigger puzzle, what does one find when we look across countries? So I wanted to say a little bit about the international evidence. What do I mean by this? Well, most of the studies that look across country find that changes in education are not highly related to economic growth, but the initial level of a country's education is related to its subsequent growth. So this is a finding in Robert Barrow's work and Paul Romer's work and other people's work. A number of economists who work in economic growth think of this as a growth externality to education. It's the initial level of education that matters for subsequent growth. But by the way, this goes back at least to Nelson and Phelps and probably earlier, that the initial level of schooling is relevant for adaptation of technology, development of new technology, and so on, which is important for growth. I'm somewhat skeptical of that interpretation. I say that in part because of work I've done together with Michael Lindahl in a paper in the Journal of Economic Literature. What we did was to try to reconcile why is it that changes in education are not related to GDP growth across periods of time. Now, most of the literature looks at very short periods of time, 5 years. And when you look across countries, their education level doesn't change very much. Average years of education does not change very much over such a short period. And I think it's a problem very similar to what we found with the twins. They're just reporting errors. They're just mistakes in the way education is calculated for different countries. And when you look at changes over time, especially over short periods of time, the reporting errors are going to dominate. Most of the variability we see are just going to be mistakes in the data because we don't have very good data on average education. It's often inferred indirectly from looking at enrollment rates and so on. If you look over long periods of time, like over a 20-year period, which is what this chart shows, you do see an upward sloping relationship. The countries that have a larger increase in schooling do tend to have faster GDP growth. But again, there's a lot of variability. I'm not going to say that education is the only thing that matters for growth, because clearly that's not the case. And clearly you can find many examples of countries where education levels increased and GDP was relatively stagnant. But looking across countries as a whole, there does tend to be an upward sloping relationship. And in fact, the slope looks pretty similar to what one finds from the cross-sectional microevidence, from the evidence I just reviewed. It looks like a payoff of around 10% in terms of GDP growth, or in terms of additional GDP, for an increase in years of schooling by about 1 year. One thing that that suggests to me is that there may be externalities from education, but they're probably not enormous. And looking for externalities from education, you might think that, well, the social return is greater than the private return. I think for a first approximation, the social return is probably about the same as the private return. You know, maybe, particularly at the bottom, where education is associated with reduced crime, Richard Friedman would have to worry less about being burglarized, the externality may exist, may be more significant in some countries where crime is a bigger issue than in other countries. But by and large, I tend to focus on the private return because I don't think that the externalities are all that large. Now, what about the growth externality? What about the effect of the initial level of education on GDP growth? Well, I'm not going to go into the details. You should read, if you're interested, the paper in the JEL. That doesn't look like a very robust finding. It seems to be a result of the kind of quirky way in which the data are aggregated. So for the average country in the world, I wouldn't expect a very strong relationship between the initial level of growth and initial level of education and subsequent growth. Well, what about the other kind of argument about education? Maybe it's not generating growth or not generating higher income because of an improvement in human capital. Maybe it's just a signal. Has anything I have discussed so far suggested that education is not just a signal? Well, I think the evidence from compulsory schooling suggests that education is not just a signal. If someone's schooling goes up because it's mandatory, that doesn't convey very much information about the person's inherent ability, and that's what you would need for education to be a useful signal. So the fact that additional schooling that comes about just because of compulsory schooling generates a fairly high return, I think weighs against the signaling model. On the other hand, you might say, well, it's kind of hard for employers to figure out if somebody got their schooling just because of compulsory schooling, and so on. There, I think the evidence from the UK is a bit stronger, where it was such a big increase in the education distribution that shifted up when the minimum schooling levels increased. And I also would say that the cross-country evidence is not necessarily suggestive of signaling either. If education were just a signal, you probably wouldn't expect to see an upward sloping relationship like this. Now, on the other hand, this relationship is not so strong. Maybe it's a result of reverse causality. You know, maybe what's going on here is that richer countries invest more in education. When countries get richer, they invest more in education. It could be just consumption. Let me help you. No, I'll help you. There we go. Okay. So I don't want to make too much of the international evidence. In fact, what I think is missing in the international evidence is the reliance on these exogenous changes that the labor economists have tried to use to look at the cross-individual evidence. Now, returning briefly to the cross-individual evidence, I wanted to emphasize that the payoff to education has increased over time. Richard, I want to correct Richard Laird on one thing. He said no important work was done on education. Well, Richard Friedman wrote an important book on the overeducated American, and you could see it was right around this period. Richard, at the end of his book, actually predicted a rebound, although I bet he's surprised by the strength of the rebound. So the returns to schooling have been increasing over time. This graph, I should have told you before I interpreted it, shows you a very simple way of looking at the payoff to education. It's the ratio of wages for college graduates to high school graduates. But if you look more generally at different levels of education, you see the same kind of pattern. This looks at the U.S. over a long period of time. Now, I think in the more recent years, it's begun to stabilize. And my impression for the U.K. is that it's similar in a way. In the 1980s, very rapid increase in the payoff to education, and then a slower increase or more of a flattening in the payoff. But it's clear that skills are more valuable now than they were before. Well, why should the government care about that if, as I said before, it's mainly a private return? And that's a question I actually ask myself from time to time. Well, I think human capital is important for the overall level of GDP. I think there are some externalities, even though they may not be so great. But probably more importantly, and it's good that Matt Raven is here, I think of this as a bit of an internality, that the individuals who drop out before they reach the compulsory schooling level or before they complete high school don't realize how high the returns are. In particular, if they have myopic preferences and they're discounting at too high a rate, then they're making mistakes. And I suspect that this is like some of the literature on smoking, where if individuals make mistakes, it's much bigger than the externalities from smoking. So that's one reason why I think public policy should care. Another is why economy should care is human capital is extremely important if you want to understand GDP. One thing I did, which I thought was kind of a fun exercise, and it's rather remarkable what it showed, I tried to decompose labor share of national income into a part that's due to just raw labor and then a part that's due to human capital. Now, how did I do this? Well, I took the Mincer model very seriously. I took the standard log linear model very seriously, and I said, let's try to predict earnings from education and experience, and then say, well, what would the earnings be for someone who has 0 years of experience and 0 years of education? I call that raw labor, but probably a better term would be intercept labor, because all I'm doing is taking the intercept from this regression. And then the rest I attribute to human capital. And what do you get? You get that most of national income is human capital. Now, you could kind of do similar types of calculations, like say, well, let's just take the minimum wage. Suppose every worker had some component of their output which is due to raw labor, and that's rewarded at the minimum wage. You get a very similar result. So much of GDP looks like it's a result of human capital. So I think this is an area where you can think of human capital as the dog that wags the tail. You know, human capital really is an important force in the economy, certainly over long periods of time. So to understand economic growth or understand levels of income, I think understanding human capital is very important. And given that, the next chart shows something which might be something of concern. This looks at the U.S. I asked earlier if anyone knows of something similar for the U.K. It'd be an interesting thing to try to put together. This is from a paper by Claudia Golden and Larry Katz. What they did was to try to compute average years of schooling by year of birth over a long period of time. So this strings together various censuses, tries to look at people when they're around age 35, and it computes just average years of schooling for people born in 1876 every year up through 1975. And what you can see is fairly steady expansion of educational attainment in the United States until the cohort born in the early 1950s. Then you see a distinct flatter trend. Okay, so we had very rapid increase, steady increase in educational attainment for nearly 100 years, and then in the last 25 years or so, much flatter expansion in educational attainment. Now remember before I emphasized that time on task, and I think of time in school as time on task, is an important component of developing human capital. This suggests that the expansion in human capital is slower than it was in the past. Now, I don't want to be alarmist about some of the trends I'm going to describe, because often in the United States, and I presume the UK is similar, people will say the current generation of students are not learning as much as the previous generation, skills are atrophying, and so on. Well, that's not the case. It's just slower expansion. So when you want to think about growth, what's relevant, I believe, is the increase in education, the increase in human capital. It's just growing more slowly. It's not that it's growing in the wrong direction. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about test scores, measuring cognitive ability. And it's really impossible to work in the education field and not do some work on test scores. And I think this is one area where economists could really make a major contribution by learning more psychometrics. I include myself in that group. Because we tend to take the output of the standardized tests that are administered and just run with them. And it's unlike any other area where economists are insistent that we look at revealed preference and actual behavior. When it comes to test scores, we just seem to accept what comes out of the testing agencies. And there are a lot of subtle issues involved here, how the tests are scaled, how they're administered, how much weight is is given to various sections, and they're very rarely validated against real outcomes, the kinds of outcomes that economists are interested in. Princeton is located, some of you may know this, in Princeton. All of you know that Princeton's located in Princeton. So is the Educational Testing Service, ETS. ETS gives the SAT exam and the graduate record exam. And I gave a talk there about education and the economy, and they were really surprised to see that their tests had anything to do with economic outcomes. When they designed the test, they don't have economic outcomes in mind at all. What I think we've learned in this area is that both cognitive and non-cognitive ability, as measured by the standardized tests, are correlated with income. The cognitive test scores seem to work primarily through educational attainment, not so much through being smarter by itself is important. What seems to be the case is that test scores are strongly correlated with income because they're correlated with education. Once you condition on education, the relationship is much weaker between test scores and income. Nevertheless, it is the case, and there's a very nice paper by Sandy Jenks and Meredith Phillips that shows if you look at how students' test scores increase, say from 10th grade to 12th grade in their study, the increase in their testing, in their test scores, is related to their subsequent income. So that suggests to me that the test scores are relevant. And the next slide shows just the raw relationship between test scores and earnings. And this is various quartiles of the distribution of test scores and average earnings. And you can see that there's a monotonic relationship here. So it's really kind of unavoidable to look at test scores. One reason why it's unavoidable, I think, is that in the education area, it's very important to get evaluation before it's too late. I didn't show you any of the work that I did together with David Card on how school resources relate to earnings. I didn't prepare any of that. The reason is because when I talk about this to people in the policy world, they say, well, we can't wait another 25, 30 years to see whether the schools were working well. Well, now, you know, we need an intermediate measure. And that tends to be test scores. I put together some interesting evidence, kind of new in this next slide, on how test scores have been varying over time in the U.S. Now, one of the big problems in this area is getting consistent data on test scores over time is basically impossible. In the U.S., we have data called the NAEP, National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is a standardized test intended to be comparable over time, which began in the early 70s. Well, suppose you want to look back over a longer period of time. It's pretty much hopeless. So what I've been doing together with an undergraduate at Princeton is to try to put together a longer series by looking at the International Adult Literacy Survey. Now, this is a cross-sectional survey which tests people at a point in time, but they're different ages, so they were born in different cohorts. So what we've done is to look by year of birth. Now, one problem, of course, with this is that the individuals are being tested at different ages. Some of them, they were tested in 1991, so some are in their late 50s, early 60s. Some are as young as 20. Well, maybe people forget things as they get older. I know I have been. there may be some, or maybe they learn more things. One possibility is that there's an independent effect of aging. Actually, rather surprisingly, we don't find that, at least not for the ages that we're looking at. You do find it if you look at older ages. But one thing that we did was to look where we could use the same test at different times, 10 years apart. For example, a study in Sweden where the IALS was given 10 years apart. You really don't see much change across the cohorts as they age. So I think of these as mainly cohort effects. But even if you're skeptical of that, and there's probably reason for skepticism, in a moment I'm going to compare across countries. So as long as the effect of aging is the same in England and the United States and I'll show you Sweden, then these are, will say something about the changes in the preparation of the students over time. So what do you see for the U.S.? For the U.S., you see kind of gradual improvement in quantitative literacy, prose literacy, document literacy, all three exams, and then that kind of peaks out for the cohort born in the early 50s, mid-50s. It's been stagnant since then, and maybe a slight dip towards the end. To the extent we do have other standardized tests, they tend to mirror this picture. The NAEP data, where they overlap, shows the same pattern. So that gives me some other confidence, additional confidence in these results. The next figure shows the UK. You could tell from the flag. And what does this show? Well, a rather interesting pattern, kind of stagnant for the 1930s cohort, then rather sharp increase, and then stagnant again from the late 1940s all the way through to the most recent cohorts that we looked at. Now, one possibility, and we started to explore this, is that compulsory schooling is part of this growth, because remember, we're testing individuals as adults. So these are the periods when there were big increases in the compulsory schooling laws. So far, we don't have that strong evidence linking this to compulsory schooling, but it's something I haven't given up on yet. And the pattern, I would say, for the UK, at least for the cohorts born after 1950, is similar to the US, fairly stagnant trend in test scores. And these results, I've scaled these the exact same. So if, Ben, if you could go backwards by hitting page up. You'll see that the levels are about the same. If you hit page down again, you go back to the UK. The levels are about the same. US got there a little bit faster. We might not be staying at that at that average level. And the other international tests point in the same direction. I was looking this morning at the TIMSS data, and the US and the UK are not significantly apart from each other. So that again gives me some confidence in these data. Now I want to show you one other country, which is Sweden. That's the next chart. And you can see Sweden has more continuous increase and also higher average levels on the IALS. And that also shows up in some other international tests as well. So what can we do to improve human capital? This next slide, I'm sure many of you recognize the library there, which Ben and I downloaded from the web yesterday. What can be done? Well, I think the first thing to notice is that improving human capital is not going to be cheap. There's really not a cheap solution. What are the main costs? The main costs, we emphasize the opportunity cost of student time. That's what the Mincer model emphasizes. I wanted to say something kind of an aside. I noticed when this talk was advertised, it mentioned that I would talk about human capital accounts. I'll only briefly say something about human capital accounts. I'm part of a National Academy of Sciences panel in the US to try to have satellite accounts to measure human capital. And in the process of doing this, we're looking at the costs. And it dawned on us that, you know, we think about the opportunity costs, and of course, Ben could be working. Well, he is working. But when he's in school, he could be working and earning a salary. But at really young ages, it's improbable that the students would be working and making a salary. And I think it's probably more appropriate to think of school as also providing daycare services. While the children are in school, in most cases, the mother could be out working. And in fact, if you value the amount of time saved or the value of the daycare services to the mother, it actually swamps the opportunity cost. So if you look at primary and secondary schooling, on net, the opportunity cost is very, very small. Because at most ages, until you get up to about age 11 or 12, you can think of the time that the student is in school under supervision as providing kind of this complementary benefit, the daycare services. But there also is obviously family time, and I think that's an important part of the cost. Teacher salaries, and you know, if you recognize when you look at school budgets that teacher salaries are the largest part of the budget, therefore having more teachers makes schooling more costly. The pupil-teacher ratio is a very important component of schooling costs. So, flip to the next slide. Some people have argued that there's a great deal of inefficiency. My friend Eric Hanischek at the Hoover Institute argues that close to 400 studies of student achievement demonstrate there's not a strong or consistent relationship between student performance and school resources. So that suggests that maybe if we can get rid of this waste, we can improve human capital on the cheap. Well, I'm skeptical of that for a couple of reasons. One is I'm skeptical that the 400 studies actually show that. I'm even skeptical that there are 400 studies. I'll tell you what I mean by that. If you hit the next slide, what Hanischek did was to take studies, 59 in all, looking at class size, and to take multiple estimates from some of those studies. So he took 277 estimates from 59 separate published articles, and he classified whether they found a positive impact of smaller classes or a negative impact or an impact of unknown sign. Rather remarkable, 20% had an impact of unknown sign. Kind of wonder what kind of study was this if it didn't report the sign of the coefficient. But if you look at this, it looks like a coin flip. It looks just as likely to get a positive effect as a negative effect. And I actually think that's a misleading result because of the way the estimates were extracted. Some studies, two in particular, 24 estimates were taken. Study David Card and I published in the Journal of Political Economy, one estimate was taken. The study from which the 24 estimates were taken, those two studies, actually use the exact same data set. So you might say, are these really independent estimates? If you go to the next chart, What this shows you, it breaks down. A unit of observation here is the study, not an estimate. So there were 17 studies from which one estimate was taken. They overwhelmingly found positive impacts of smaller classes. Then there were other studies where 2 to 7 estimates were taken, and they also disproportionately found positive estimates. There were 9 studies from which 8 or more estimates were taken. They accounted for 44% of these 277 estimates, and those are the ones that showed the negative impact. And you look at those studies and you say, oh my goodness, we're going to make policy based on these 9 studies. Many of them actually were not interested in class size at all. One of the reasons why they didn't report their signs is because they were interested in the effect of family income on student outcomes. And they just estimated a kitchen sink regression, which controlled for expenditures per student as well as the pupil-teacher ratio, and they didn't bother to report those signs. They're not necessarily bad studies. They just weren't relevant for this issue. So this work by Hanischek has had a major impact in public policy circles, both in the US and the UK, and I'm skeptical of that conclusion. And I think, you know, the way to dig into this literature is to look at the best design studies. And I think the best design is from a study called the Tennessee Star Experiment, which was an actual experiment where class size was randomly reduced for randomly selected classes in Tennessee, beginning with the cohort of students who started school in 1986. The normal size class was 22 students. There was a range around that, of course. And they were reduced to 15 on average in the small classes. This lasted for 4 years, so it just started with this one wave of students, and they were tracked for 4 years. They were more or less kept in the same classes that they were originally assigned to. The teachers were randomly assigned as well. And the next chart shows results for the wave of students who started in kindergarten. And kindergarten in the U.S. is the first year of schooling. You might call that year one. And what you see is at the end of the first year of schooling, the students who were randomly assigned to the small classes were scoring higher, about 5 percentile points higher. By the end of the second year of school, they were up to about 6 points higher than the students in the regular size classes. And then it fell back down to 5 points, which is interesting. Now, this is in terms of percentile ranks. And it suggests that that gap was kind of stable for the next couple of years when the students were in small classes. And I've been tracking these students since then. They've graduated from high school. Many have gone on to college. And I've done a long-term study. This next chart shows I was displaying the results for Hillary Clinton and Senator Patty Murray. And I was at a microphone like this, and I went over to point to what happened after the experiment ended, and the students went to regular size classes, and somebody said, don't leave the microphone. And Mrs. Clinton said, don't worry, we'll bring the chart over to you. So you can see I have a history of having very good assistance for my talks. And what did we find in the longer term? This next slide shows the longer term follow-up. Some of the gains looked like they faded. So the gap, which was 5 or 6 points, looked like it fell maybe to 3 percentile ranks. But it did persist. High school graduation was higher for the students who were in the smaller classes. College aspirations, as measured by where the students applied to college, were higher. The achievement on the college entrance exams, the ACT or SAT, was higher. And we have some data on crime and arrests. And for the male students, the arrest rates were a little bit lower. And if you flip to the next slide, the effects were not uniform. We found larger effects for the students who were on free lunch. Free lunch means the student's family income was close to the poverty level or within 150% of the poverty level. The minority students in Tennessee, that was African American students, benefited the most. The inner city students benefited more. Boys benefited more from smaller classes than the girls, at least in the short run. Longer run, it was interesting because when we looked at the African American students, it was mainly the female students who were more likely to go to college as a result of having been in smaller classes the first 4 years. So one interpretation I had of these results is that the small classes may have had a socialization effect. The students who were having the most difficulty in school were the ones who benefited the most. They probably learned to become students. You know, if you deal with a class of 30 kindergarten or first year students, discipline in the classroom is very important. The students, they learn how to behave as students, that can have an enormous payoff. And one of the things I suspect is that it looks like a socialization effect because it was across the board on their tests. It wasn't just the reading test or just the math test. It was on all of the tests they were given. And it was about the same improvement on all of the tests. That's a bit speculation. I want to emphasize that what happens outside of school is also important. In this next chart, says something which I think is quite important for a number of students. Lack of family support is a major problem. This is particularly true in the United States, I suspect in the UK as well. I'm going to show you something I call the Harry Potter divide in a moment. Well, I can tell you what it is. The Harry Potter divide is that Gallup actually did a survey of this, and I crunched the numbers to make sure it was correct. Gallup wanted to find out how many parents read Harry Potter to their children or their children read it themselves. They did this survey in July, 2 years ago, and they produced the results, and they said everybody's reading Harry Potter. Well, that's not quite right. Children from poor families were not reading Harry Potter during the summer. During the summertime, children from poor families get much less enrichment than children from wealthier families, and this actually shows up in test scores that I'll show you in a moment. If you flip to the next chart, this is from a study by Doris Entwistle, Kurt Alexander, and Linda Olson, who are sociologists at Johns Hopkins. They studied a group of students from many schools in Baltimore. I think it was 20 schools in Baltimore. All of them had entered first grade in 1982. And what they did was to test them at the beginning of the school year and the end of the school year with a test called the California Achievement Test. And then they broke the students down by those from low socioeconomic status families and higher socioeconomic status families. And these are the results during the school year. Now, what you can see is that the gains are about the same during the school year for the children from the low socioeconomic status families and the high socioeconomic status families. Looks like the gains are the biggest at the earlier, in the earlier years, at the younger ages. Now, that might be a true phenomenon, or it might be a result of the way these tests are scaled. I really don't know the difference. I do know the education people believe it's the case that the students make bigger gains at the earlier years until they get to graduate school. Then at graduate school, they start making big gains again. But the next chart is the one I want to emphasize. The next one shows what happens over the summer months. So again, this is tracking the students each summer, and you can see the children from the high socioeconomic status families actually on the rise. This is looking at their math scores. The students from the low socioeconomic status families are falling behind during the summer months. And the next chart accumulates them for both math and reading. And you can see during the course of the school year, the children from the low and high socioeconomic status families are making the same gains, essentially the same gains. The gap is arising because, well, they start with a gap. When they start their first year in school, there is a gap. But the gap is not expanding over the course of the school months. The gap is expanding over the summer months. It's really rather dramatic, and I suspect that this is related to the Harry Potter divide. The children from the low socioeconomic status families are not reading very much in the summer. Again, the time on task comes through. I looked at these results, and I wrote a piece for the New York Times where I proposed vouchers for summer school, where the idea was, well, why not give children from low-income families who can't afford to go to school in the summer or enrichment activities in the summer a voucher so they could use it to go to summer school. And this would give us experience with vouchers. We could see if it works. And it actually got fairly good feedback. I don't know if any community has tried it. But I think it's kind of funny because in a moment I'll show you some results which some people have tarred me as anti-voucher. And I was proposing vouchers, just a different kind of voucher, for the summer months to see how they would work, because my impression is that the regular school year is actually working reasonably well. The regular school year is not contributing to the gap in achievement between the low-achieving students and the higher-achieving the low-income students and the high-income students. I think the problem is the school year is too short. Now, I don't know how much these results travel to the UK. In the United States, our summer is almost 3 months long. Ben's been on vacation for at least a week, although he might not consider this vacation right now. And the UK, my understanding is that the grammar schools are still in session. So the school year here is certainly longer, although short compared to the school year in Japan. Okay, let me change gears rather abruptly and talk a little bit about some of the kind of magic bullets or next big things that have been proposed. One is use of computers. And I call this slide the future e-education question mark. Here's a quote from John Chambers. John Chambers is the CEO of Cisco. He might be a little bit less confident now than he was in 1999 after Cisco's stock has fallen to 20% of its previous value. But Chambers said the next big killer application for the internet is going to be education. Education over the internet is going to be so big it is going to make email usage look like rounding error. That's quite a strong statement. How has e-education been working? I just want to show you one set of results which I think are quite interesting. This is from a paper in the Journal of Economic Perspectives by Peter Navarro. Peter is a big advocate of using the internet for education, and he put together a piece for the JEP, and he surveyed people who use the internet in their instruction, and this is what he found. 92% experience technical problems. 79% of the instructors believe students perform the same or better, but I think most of that was on the same. 92% of instructors spent more time developing cyber course than the conventional course, so it doesn't seem to be more efficient in terms of the professor's time. 67% of the instructors spent more time teaching their course. Now, you might think, well, this is just setup costs. But if you read through the article, the marginal cost is actually higher. The marginal time effort is actually greater as well. So I don't think that this is going to be a major efficiency gain. Now, I do think for some students, there will be big benefits from e-education. I don't think it's going to be traditional students. I don't think it'll be primary or secondary students or college students. I think it's going to be adults who want to go back for additional training, where the flexibility of being able to do the training at their leisure when they're not at work is of a huge benefit. You know, a good example is school teachers. And I think one area where more research should be devoted is how to train teachers better, how to have them maintain their skills. And I think the internet e-education is one way. Now, the whole area of computer instruction is rather controversial. It's a really fascinating area because so much money has been poured into it, and it's the current fad, I would say. Yet so little research has been done on it, so little credible research. And the research that's been done, I think one would have to say, is mixed. Joshua Angrist and Victor Levy have probably the best paper. It looks at Israel, and I think there are some problems with the paper. It was published in the Economic Journal, but I think it is the best study, and it finds decidedly null effects, really little impact of introducing computers into schools in Israel, and that paper got a reasonable amount of attention both here and in the U.S. I wanted to just mention a study I've been doing with a colleague of mine at Princeton, Cecilia Rouse. And this next slide describes the program. It's called Fast Forward. And I have to say, if this program doesn't work, then I don't think any of them work. Fast Forward was developed by a group of neuroscientists at UCSF and at Rutgers University. And this is from the company's webpage. Fast Forward is the family of programs. It's computer-based training using the latest brain research for rapid gains in language and reading. It's produced by a company called Scientific Learning Corporation. They say that it's for anyone, for children who struggle with basic language skills or attention problems, to adults who want to improve reading and comprehension and organizational skills. Scientific Learning's programs and products have something for everyone. And you can see it won an award there that they advertise. And it's growing, it's spreading very quickly in the U.S. Now, it was developed for children who had severe learning disabilities, auditory processing problems. And the theory behind this, which is an interesting theory, is that children who have difficulty reading probably have difficulty hearing. So when the teacher reads something to the student might not pick up the nuances or the subtleties in the speech. So this takes advantage of the computer technology, and the student puts on a headset, and the computer reads to the student, but it slows down certain sounds, like the, and it emphasizes certain sounds. So in the first couple of milliseconds of the word the, you hear the TH, and it will emphasize that. So the theory is that if you kind of emphasize the difficult phonemes, that it will help with reading. And what's the evidence for it? Well, the initial evidence was from brain scans. That's why it says the latest brain research. So I learned about this program from a school superintendent who said that he was interested in sinking $3 million into this program to use it in his school district, a major urban school district in the Northeast. And they showed him these brain scans from 10 students, and they showed that the part of the brain that normal children use when they read was not activated, was not firing when these children were reading before they started this program. And afterwards, look at the brain scans, the normal part was firing the way it's supposed to. And he said to me, but I want to know if it helps them to read. So I said, well, look, before you sink in the $3 million, why don't you let us randomly select a group of students to go through it, and we'll have a control group, and we'll see how it impacts their reading scores. And he said, of course, he gets evaluated on the state reading test. That's what he cares most about. So that's exactly what we did. Now, I want to show you the other claims that the company makes. And one of the themes I mentioned earlier is kind of independent evaluations. If you have a for-profit company doing its own evaluation, they don't have the right incentives, I would say. Product might be the greatest product in the world, or it might not be, but they certainly don't have the incentive to faithfully represent the result in a scientific way. And even in this case, where I think the scientists who were involved in setting up this product are very distinguished scientists, I would worry that the profit motive might interfere. So in addition to the evidence on the brain scans, they also did administer some reading tests. This shows results, you can get this on their webpage, from the CELF, C-E-L-F exam, which is a clinical evaluation of language fundamentals. It's kind of a very, very basic reading test. And what they show you is that they took students and they tested them on the CELF exam before they went through the fast-forward program and then again afterwards. The program only takes 6 weeks on average to complete. And what did they find? Well, the average student scored an 80, well below normal beforehand, and then afterwards the average student scored about 95. And look at this tremendous progress that the students made. Now, there's no control group here. Maybe that was just a normal maturation process. The students get older, maybe they got more familiar with the test and they just did better. There's another problem in this evaluation. The way this program works is the students are tested at the end of each week. If they pass the test, then they go on to the next level. They only included students in this evaluation who passed the test and went on to the next level. So they did another study where they did random assignment. They did a control experiment where they randomly assigned the treatment group and the control, but they did the same thing, where they only included students in the treatment group if they had completed the program. Now, I think that really doesn't stand up to scientific rigor, although the results have been published in journals. So I think it makes it difficult to evaluate for the schools to evaluate kind of what is scientifically valid research. And this does get the stamp of approval for scientifically valid research. So Cecilia Rouse and I have been doing this evaluation, which we summarize here. What did we do? We took four schools in the school district, and we randomly selected the students, 513 students in all. They were in years 4 through 7 in school. To be eligible, they needed to score in the bottom, I think it was the bottom 20% on the statewide reading exam. And we administered the CELF exam. We gave them, or the schools gave them the statewide reading test. We've given them some other tests as well. And what did we find? If you skip the next slide, Ben, go one more. What this shows is the test scores before and after. And just like the Scientific Learning Corporation, we found that the scores were higher program than they were before for the treatment group, but it was the same for the controls, and in fact the difference was not statistically significant. Now we show you standard error bars here, and these are, you know, reasonably wide standard error bars. Maybe we don't have very much power. So I wanted to show you, we do have power against what the company claimed. This next slide shows you here, the bar goes all the way up to what the Scientific Learning Corporation had claimed the improvement on the CELF exam was in that previous slide, a full standard deviation. It's not a separate slide. I'm sorry, Ben is correcting me. I should also give credit. Ben figured out how to do this all in one slide and have that pop up the way it did. And what you could see is if the results were nearly as strong as what the Scientific Learning Corporation had claimed, we would have been able to detect them. If they were half as large, we would have been able to detect them. But we were not able to detect impacts. When we looked at the state reading test, we found the same thing. There's another study that's been done at the same program, done at the same time as us, by Jeff Borman and Laura Rachuba. This next slide describes what they've done. A kind of similar design. They looked at schools in Baltimore. It was 8 schools about the same size, 415 students. Anyway, what did they find? This next figure shows you what they found. Basically, they found no difference between the treatments and controls in terms of the improvement on the CTPS exam. That's another standardized test, and it's a test more of reading skills than kind of the precursor to reading skills. If you look at their confidence intervals and our confidence intervals, we can't reject a small impact. You know, if the impact was a tenth of a standard deviation, then we probably can't reject it. Now, they're claiming a full standard deviation increase. That's an enormous increase. The program costs $1,000 to administer. So if you could raise the students' reading skills by full standard deviation, I mean, that's tremendous. If you think about their lifetime income, that's just enormous. So, you know, I think if you put things in perspective, you'd have to say, can it really deliver what it's promising? It just seems like it's too large an increase to be believed. Not to say that maybe this program is worth it, actually. You know, if it really raised scores by a tenth of a standard deviation for only $1,000, I would say it was worth it. But it's almost impossible to detect an impact that small, at least with the samples that we have. And I have to say, I'm skeptical that it has much impact at all. So the last topic I want to talk about is the other magic bullet, which is popular in the United States, in some circles, school vouchers. And I have to be careful the way I use language here, because when in the U.S. we talk about private schools and public schools, I notice when I talk to people from Britain, we get confused. So what I mean is providing money for families to send their children to independent schools or schools that charge a fee. And the Supreme Court recently ruled that it is constitutional for schools, for communities to give money to families to send their children to religious schools. The reason why that's relevant is in the United States, 90% of the students who go to private school go to religious schools. In the United States, we have a tradition of separation of church and state in the Constitution. So the only religious schools are the schools that charge a fee. And for a long time, it was believed that the Supreme Court would probably rule that that's unconstitutional. The court changed, and by a 5-4 margin, it ruled that it is constitutional for local districts to use their funds to pay, to give families money to send their children to religious schools. It's believed that that will open the door up to vouchers. When this decision was reached, George Bush said this is going to be as significant as Brown versus Board of Education. I thought that was a rather remarkable comment, because Brown versus Board of Education had absolutely no impact for 15 years. Brown versus Board of Education, if you look at the amount of segregation after Brown's decision in 1954, there was no change. There was no change until the late 60s. It doesn't mean that this court ruling won't have an impact. It certainly will not have an impact over the next 10 years, I would say. Nevertheless, when there are complaints about the current school system, vouchers are often proposed as a solution. Now, I think vouchers are an extremely complicated topic. I think complicated in part because of separation of church and state, complicated because if you go back to what Milton Friedman said about vouchers, or go back to what Tom Paine, since we're close to July 4th, I'll cite Tom Paine, said about vouchers. The idea was not so much that vouchers would improve cognitive abilities, just that there would be more competition, and that would help both the publicly funded schools and the privately funded schools. The research that's been done on vouchers has looked primarily at, do students who attend schools that charge a fee perform better? Is there, does it look like there's an advantage in terms of their the skills that they're learning by attending schools that charge a fee? And the main evidence, I would say, at this point comes from a series of randomized experiments that were done by Paul Peterson of Harvard. The best one looked at New York City, and I'll show you results from New York, but they pretty much all show the same set of results. For New York, Peterson and Mathematica Policy Research, a private research company, got together and conducted an experiment. And the experiment summarized in that next slide. Actually, my paper's advertised on the next slide. I might as well give this brief advertisement. You'll notice here I have all of my affiliations. Woodrow Wilson School, we found the Great Seal of the Industrial Relations section recently in the archives, and then something new called the Educational Research section, which Cecilia Rouse heads up. And together with Pei Zhu, who's a graduate student at Princeton, for the last 3 years, we've been retracing through the steps in the New York City voucher experiment. And I will not bore you with all of the details now, but on Friday, on July 4th, I am giving a seminar at IFS on this paper, another look at the New York City voucher experiment. So this next slide summarizes the experiment. How did it work? Well, this was a major experiment, extremely expensive to carry this out. It involved 2,600 students in all. 1,300 were randomly selected to be offered a voucher, which they could use to go to private school. The voucher had an amount of $1,400. The families were told, since you were randomly selected, you could use this for the next 3 years, $1,400 a year for the next 3 years. Now, that doesn't sound like much money, and it's actually not that much money. It's about half of the cost of the average school that charges a fee. These are, remember, mainly Catholic schools, religious schools, so they're not too expensive. And many of the schools chipped in additional money for the children to go there. The families also supplemented the money. And the students were followed up for the next 3 years. What's interesting about this is that small amount of money, $1,400, caused 80% of the treatment students to switch over to the private schools. And if you look at the control group students, it was only 10% who actually went to a private school. So actually, a small amount of money had an enormous impact on their enrollment in private school. what else can I tell you about this? This started in 1997. It went on for 3 years. It ended in 2000. And what were the results? The next slide shows what I consider to be the most relevant results. Well, sorry, they flipped because I'm out of time. I won't go over the problems. The next slide, then, thank you. This shows you the average scores on the Iowa Skills Test for the treatment group and the control group. And the way that this is scaled, by the way, this is also relevant. These were all poor students. So every student that participated in this experiment had to be on free lunch, again, within 150% of the poverty line. So you can see the average score is at the 25th percentile. So we're talking about the bottom of the distribution. And the treatment group, which is a group that was offered the voucher, is in blue. The control group is in crimson. I use that for Harvard. And you can see no difference, no detectable difference. This looks at all students as a whole. Now, I think that is most relevant for the UK because it says if you look at the full sample, there was no difference. Now, in the US, we're particularly concerned about minority populations. And results were broken out for African-American students and Hispanic students. For African-American students, it was claimed that there was a positive impact. And in fact, the headlines from this study were vouchers work, which is actually remarkable given what a complicated issue this is. William Safire wrote a piece in the New York Times where in the middle of the election 2 years ago where he said George Bush is for vouchers. This study shows that vouchers caused a stunning reversal in the fortunes of the African-American students. Well, because of that, I was interested, why did the African-American students gain? And as Richard Freeman pointed out to me before, if the average effect was zero, somebody must have lost. Well, for the Hispanic students, there was a small negative impact. And that's why the two canceled out. Well, I come away quite skeptical of the results for the African-American students. If you flip to the next slide, there were, I think, some problems in the way the experiment was done and the way that the children were classified as African-American or non-African-American. And if you use a plausible sample, a broader sample, you get no significant difference, a p-value of 0.3. If you want to test the difference between the group that was offered a voucher or not, the difference easily could have arrived by chance. And it was small. It was at 1.4 percentile ranks. You know, a very small difference between the groups. That's about 0.05 standard deviations. So what I took away from this experiment was there was very little difference in the performance of the students who were offered a voucher and the students who were not offered a voucher. And I think that's what much of the literature says. Certainly when you look at the population of students as a whole, there's not much reason to suggest that the private schools are performing much better, that the schools that charge a fee are performing much better than the state-funded schools. Now, this isn't to say that vouchers are irrelevant. It may be that competition will have a bigger impact. I guess I'm a little bit concerned that if we do have a system where there's much more choice and the schools that are in it to make a profit, they may exaggerate what they find what they produce. They may focus on religious education, which I don't think is necessarily in the state's interest. So I worry a little bit about that. On the other hand, it also may be the case that the publicly funded schools will sense some competition. Maybe they'll innovate in ways which we can't anticipate, and that will increase productivity. My own personal guess is that's probably unlikely. Also, I think there's probably little reason for families to switch schools if what they're seeking is higher skills attainment for the students, because I think the evidence suggests very little gain. So why don't I just wrap up briefly. Conclusions. As I have emphasized, human capital is important. I think the current trends are a cause of some concern. I don't want to sound shrill and exaggerate those concerns, but I think there's been a period of slower growth and in some respects stagnation in terms of skill attainment. Unfortunately, I don't see a bargain basement solution. Maybe there's one out there. I don't think we found it yet. It seems to me that the time-intensive strategy has worked in the past, and by that I mean expanding years of schooling, expanding the length of the school year, although we stopped doing that too in the United States in the early 50s. And you know, if I were to give advice to policymakers, it would be, well, why don't we continue on with the time-intensive strategy until we figure out what works or what might be more efficient. That's why I think the bottom point here, there's a high payoff to requiring randomized experiments by independent evaluators, because I think we have to worry about the incentives of the companies when they do the evaluations. Now, the U.S. is moving in that direction. We passed a bill called No Child Left Behind. It's a very complicated bill. I called it in the past the largest unfunded mandate in United States history. because it mandates certain outcome levels, which I don't think are attainable, at least if the accountability measures are fairly implemented. Nevertheless, in that bill, it requires scientifically based research. That's left very vague what that means. And the research that I talked about for Fast Forward, I suspect, would classify as scientifically based research. So I think we have to worry about the incentives of the evaluators. And even when the evaluations are done by academics, I think we need to worry. I have to say that the New York study was a real eye-opener to me. I was quoted in the New York Times as saying, I came away a bit disillusioned. I hate to end on such a sour note. But I came away disillusioned because you read the reports that were produced by Mathematica and Peterson, and it looks like the kind of research you would really hope to see in public policy. Randomized evaluations, there were reasonably large samples, attrition wasn't so bad, there was some research into what the attrition was like, an attempt to adjust the sample weights for attrition. And then when you get a hold of the data, you find out, well, 40% of the observations weren't used, and it wasn't mentioned anywhere, which tended to have an impact on the results for the African-American students. So one of the things I came away with is that really don't trust anything unless a number of eyes have looked at it. And what I mean by that, unless people really have used the data and analyzed it and put it to the test. So I wasn't so cynical in the past. But what that led me to believe is that it's really quite important for the future in education and economics more generally for there to be more of an ethic of sharing data. So at that note, I should end. I just want to thank my son for... That's you, for so competently handling my slides for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Why did you stay here?
Sure.
Alan, thank you very much. Absolutely amazing tour of really interesting material. Have we got a mic somewhere? Yep. Gentleman in the middle there.
Is this on?
Yeah, Bernard Casey from London School of Economics. I was interested in your Katzenkruger 99 paper.
Okay.
Is that working?
Mm-hmm.
With the changes in rate of return over time. Those are private rates of return. I think it was Richard Friedman who made this point some a while ago, that of course the comparator group is changing over time as well. And if all these people are actually going into higher education, which is what we have seen in this country, where the best part of 45-50% of the cohort is going into higher education, to compare them with the one rank below that is actually comparing them with a very different group of people than we were comparing them with 10-20 years ago. So I'm concerned about what's happening to private rates of return over time, in fact. I'm also concerned about what's happening to social rates of return, which are not talked about, except perhaps in terms of the contribution to growth. One of the reasons why those might be holding up is simply because, just a minute, is because, A, we are actually managing to cut costs of provision quite dramatically, which means more students per book. And the other thing which I find rather interesting is that as university teachers, I mean, clearly our marginal product is in severe decline and has been in so for some time. One of the reasons why we can get these things cheaper is because they're cutting our pay.
There's a lot to respond to there. Let me not comment on the cutting the pay. I'm not entirely sure I heard the first point correctly. It's probably just my problem because I didn't hear you all that well. If you look at the U.S. and you follow the same cohorts, so it's not so much comparing apples and oranges where you have one group where education went up a lot. You just follow the same group of people. You know, follow people in their 30s as they go to their 40s. You see an increase in the payoff to schooling. That suggests to me that this is not a result of changes in the composition. That's a way that the labor market is rewarding people who have a certain skill set. And, you know, it's possible that it's an aging effect, but if you look at earlier periods, it doesn't look like it's an aging effect. It looks like it's my reading of the evidence, it looks like it's an impact in the way the economy is rewarding skills. And you see that in some other measures as well. The U.S., if you look at the birth cohorts, the cohort that was entering school in the 1990s was actually a fairly small cohort compared to the cohorts that were going through school and colleges in the 1970s, which is the main margin for expanding education. So it's not going to change the composition all that much anyway. But I think the more relevant part is if you follow the same cohorts, you see an increase in the returns. Yes?
My name is Jim Kennedy. Your research, of course, your data reflect the situation in the USA and to a lesser extent the UK. I'm thinking in particular of your graph showing the earnings rise with education and wondering whether in other countries you have any evidence that this is reflected in positive policy measures concerning the funding of higher education. For example, something vaguely comparable to what in this country is top-up fees or student loans.
Well, it's certainly the case if you look in other countries, you find an upward sloping relationship between earnings and education. In fact, I'm not aware of any country where you don't find it. And if you look at communist countries, you tend to find it. I've been doing some work on Sweden, and if you look at Sweden, the returns to education are lower than they are in the United States. But then if you take into account the fact that education, there's no direct tuition cost, and there are actually pretty large subsidies in terms of living expenses, and you Richard Friedman has a book with Larry Katz, which has a paper by Per Anders Edin and Bertil Holman, where they calculate the rate of return taking into account taxes, both after the students enter the labor force and the subsidies they get while they're in school. And it actually substantially raises the payoff to getting schooling in Sweden. Kind of surprising how much it does. And we've updated that. We looked more recently, and we get the same kind of pattern. It rises to the U.S. level. I don't know anyone who's looked so systematically to say, are countries doing what seems to be in their interest? Because clearly the institutions of the country affect the payoff to education. You know, I think there's no doubt that institutions matter, the extent of unionization matters for the distribution of wages and the rewards, the skills. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think the technology matters as well. And you could say, well, if you have a country where the returns are depressed, but it's still in the country's interest to expand education, are they subsidizing it appropriately? I'm not aware of much work that has looked at that across countries.
If I'm going to take one point away from the lecture to remember, it might be the idea that time is the key thing. The more time children spend being educated, the further they're going to get, the more they're going to earn, or something like that. This means that what I've seen in Japan of people doing juku all night long, staying in school on Saturdays, having very short holidays. The holiday between school years is only 2 or 3 weeks at Easter time. Kids are just drilled the whole time. I'm a little bit horrified that the policy implications of your studies should perhaps support moving in that direction.
I don't know if that's so horrifying. I thought you were going to say, well, why is Japan doing so poorly lately, which is a harder question. I think one of the reasons why Japan did so extraordinarily well for such a long period of time, why it grew so much, was because human capital was expanding so much. And I think you see that in a number of the Asian countries. What's unusual to me about Japan is that the college years seem to be a time when the students don't invest that much in their human capital. It seems like they, in the U.S. we would say they party when they're in college. I don't know what the saying would be here. And that seems to me kind of hard to figure out in Japan.
They're fed up with it.
I'm sorry?
I said they're fed up with it.
It could well be. That could be, or I think it's more because of the way workers are sorted to jobs. And it's, for whatever reason, it's based on where they place to get into college, not what they get when they're coming out of college. I think their incentives are for them not to work so hard when they're in college. But I don't think it's necessarily so horrifying. I think what's more horrifying, now this is speaking for the U.S., is having children unsupervised in the summer who are kind of, their skills are atrophying, they're not doing anything productive, and many of them are doing destructive things.
Hi, my name's David Arculus. Do you think there's a kind of optimal level in the economy of people that should go through higher education for the benefit of the economy? I mean, one of the debates here is that, you know, broadly the government wants to put 50% of people through higher education. 25% probably leave school when they can. And the other kind of section, there are just not enough skilled craftsmen in the economy. I mean, have you observed any effects like that? I mean, if all 75% went through university, what would happen to the economy then?
Right, right. That's an excellent question, because most of what I've been talking about is partial equilibrium. And when you look cross-sectionally, you're holding, you know, all those other things constant. You're talking about moving one worker to get compulsory schooling or kind of a small group. It didn't look to me when I, you know, as I think back about this study that Harman and Walker did on the UK when compulsory schooling went up, where there clearly was an expansion in educational attainment, that that depressed the return. Now, that was probably a smaller margin than what you're talking about now, but it was a pretty big increase. There are some cases, there are certainly some cases where rapid increase in educational attainment reduced the payoff to education. Most dramatic is in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, where in the 1980s there was very rapid increase in educational attainment. There was very little capital investment, there was no banking system, and the returns to education declined, and I think reaped havoc. There's also some question about kind of what skills the students were getting in the schools, because much of it was religious. But there's certainly some risk for that. And I think if you look at the U.S., some of what's driving the changes we've had in the payoff to skills, this goes back to Richard's work, is the size of the cohorts and the expansion of the education across those cohorts. I tend to think over a long enough period, especially when you have flexible capital markets, that the return is relatively stable. On the other hand, I'd also say, this is an argument we used to make when I was at the Labor Department, and I think it's a tremendous exaggeration to say I was very successful when I worked at the Labor Department. I don't think one bill passed that we were in favor of in the year I worked at the Labor Department. But one point that we used to make, because at the time we were pushing for lifelong learning and for, I don't know if you remember this, President Clinton favored that community college should become as common, or at least 2 years of education beyond high school should become as common as high school. And I think he was aware, at least intuitively, of this flattening in the trend. And one of the points that we made is a major problem we have in the United States, and I think you have in the UK too, is the pulling apart of the income distribution. And if you increase the number of more highly skilled workers, well, that probably will depress the skills, even though the return to skills, even though it's starting at such a high level, it'll still be high, but it'll probably be somewhat lower. But skilled labor and unskilled labor look like they're complementary, just like capital and skilled labor look like they're complementary. So if you have more skilled labor, then that should actually raise the pay for the less skilled. I mean, there'll be less competition for them because the group is smaller. Plus skill and unskilled labor look like they're complements. So, you know, I actually view that as a positive impact of the policy. On the other hand, it's very hard. I think when you start asking these general equilibrium questions, it's very hard to make much headway on how large the effects are.
Last question.
Actually, going on from returns to education, you showed a graph on the returns comparing the ratio of graduate wage to high school wage, and there's a significant drop in the 1970s, and I'm not that familiar with the US economy in the 1970s, so I was wondering why that drop was, if there was a minimum wage there or if unemployment was high. Do you have any explanation?
Right. Well, we have one of the, probably the leading expert in the world here, so I'll be somewhat cautious in what I say, but my impression, it was mainly driven by rapid increase in schooling. It relates to the previous question. Rapid increase in schooling for cohorts that were very big. The baby boom cohorts, which were entering the labor force in the 70s, were large, and they had rapid increase in schooling. Now, I used to think that that was a result of the Vietnam War. You know, it would have been a great explanation, because in the United States, for many years, for certain parts of the war, students could avoid the draft by virtue of being students. And it was believed, and you can point to lots of examples, many academics older than me in the United States will say they only got a PhD because they wanted to avoid being drafted and sent to Vietnam. And there are two kind of puzzles if you want to take that as an exogenous, the reason for the exogenous increase in school enrollment, there are two puzzles for that. One is, Joshua Angrist and I wrote a paper where we got information on people's draft lottery numbers. There was a lottery to get drafted into the Army then. And if you had a bad draft lottery number, well, then you had much more incentive to stay in college. If you had a good lottery number, then it really didn't matter if you dropped out. You weren't at risk of being drafted. I don't know if you remember this. This came up with Dan Quayle. Dan Quayle was worried about being drafted, and he didn't do what others, many others did in that cohort, which was to enroll in school and stay in school the whole time. He got put into the National Guard through some connections. So actually, Angrist and I looked at his draft lottery number to see at what risk was it. He was very risk-averse. He was not likely to be drafted with the lottery number that he had. You know, the conventional wisdom was a lot of people went for higher education simply because of draft avoidance. And if you want to think of it as an economic explanation, well, the cost of not going to college was higher. We found no relationship at all between the risk that they faced for being drafted and whether they went on to college or whether they went on to graduate school. And we tried as hard as we could to tease out a pattern in these data. We couldn't find it. It ruined the second part of our paper, which was we wrote it anyway, which was a real mistake. The second part was to say, well, what's the value of the extra schooling you got because of your draft avoidance? And I always thought John Bowne took aim at the wrong paper, because this was the paper with the weak instrument. And in fact, we kind of fess up to that. We have a version that we published. We say this there's no power in this instrument. It was just a spurious estimate that we had when we looked at the returns to that. The second puzzle is women. The school enrollment patterns for women are the same as men, and women were not at risk of being drafted. Now, you could tell a story, well, the women wanted to go to college because the men were there, and it had to do with the marriage market, not the labor market and that kind of thing. So it's a bit of a puzzle to me why enrollment went up so much. Now, as I looked at that graph, you know, from Golden and Katz, it was going up pretty steadily, so maybe it's not such a puzzle. It was just the previous trend, and those were very big cohorts. And this is a point that Richards emphasized, that those cohorts entering the labor market then were quite large. I don't think it's been because of a major change in technology, which kind of hurt the more highly skilled. David Otter, Larry Katz, and I, and others have looked, you know, you have to make a lot of assumptions in the process of doing this, but we've tried to say, you know, is technological change responsible? Has there been some acceleration, deceleration in technological change, which is skill biased? And it looks, you know, the first order approximation, there's been a fairly steady increase in demand for the more highly skilled. I mean, you can see that because the United States and the United Kingdom, there's been pretty gradual increase in educational attainment of the workforce, yet the returns to education have been going up. They haven't fallen. So that suggests that there are many other explanations, and I think there are many other factors that are responsible, but I think technological change is a big part of it. I don't think you could say that the technological change was sudden. I mean, I think I used to talk about this incorrectly. I don't think it's that the computer, the PC spread in the 1980s. IBM PC only started in 1982. That was a dramatic change in the way work was done, and that's what caused this change. I think that's an inaccurate description. Often people describe the events in the 1980s in the U.S. that way. I think it's more that there's been fairly steady technological change in the direction of greater demand for more highly skilled workers, less demand for the less skilled, juxtaposed against pretty big shifts in relative supply.
Alan, thank you so much. I think we all feel this has been an incredibly impressive lecture, but what strikes me is how impressive the research behind it is. And what you can see is how every time some absolutely insoluble problem crops up in an argument, Alan and his colleagues, they find some way of throwing some kind of valid light on it. I don't think we've got to the light completely at the end of the tunnel, but I think the progress through the tunnel is amazingly impressive, and it's really wonderful the way it's adding up, and I think we all agree that education matters, and thanks very much to you, Alan. And to
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.